High FM 101.9 megahertz of life.
The issue around reporting, of course, is a significant one. We've seen the influence of media here in South Africa. We've seen it around the world. And one of the news organizations that have come under particular focus is Al Jazeera. It has been banned from some countries around the world, but it still somehow seems to have a significant influence. And according to Andrew Fox, for some inexplicable reason, Al Jazeera is still not banned in the UK. Major Andrew Fox, former British Army officer, joins us this morning. A very good morning to you. Thanks again for joining. How are you?
Good morning. Yes, very well. Thank you.
So I want to have a series of discussions with you, but let's just start with the Al Jazeera story, because to some extent it's the part of warfare that is most visible but least noticeable in terms of Hamas strategy. Give us your thoughts on how this has played out.
Yeah, well, there's a very clear pathway for how Hamas gets its message out to the world. You know, they've got a network of their own tame, what they call journalists on the ground, who will push stuff to various news stations who tend to repeat it verbatim. But the difference with Al Jazeera is that they're very keen to pick up and run with the disinformation that Hamas pushes out. I mean, obviously everything coming out of Gaza is skewed and has a spin on it for Hamas. But the critical thing is that things like the Al-Shifa sexual assault allegations against the IDF that were retracted within 24 hours, you know, this is the sort of stuff Al Jazeera is more than happy to run with and then delete later on down the line, because the story and the narrative are already out there. So it's a very clear pathway. And that's before we get to Al Jazeera Arabic, which is just a very different beast, and it is pure poison at all times. And that's why even the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank in Samaria have banned it.
So it's banned on the West Bank.
Yeah, absolutely. The Palestinian Authority have banned it, along with another of a large number of Arab nations.
I mean, that is remarkable, and yet, get around the world, in the UK, here in South Africa, it's relied upon as though they're Sky, BBC, and Al Jazeera.
Yeah, I know. It's astonishing, and there's a very different sort of tone to their output in Arabic. You can go on X and you can look at AJA Palestine, which is the one that's been banned there, and it's, you know, the links to Hamas are undeniable. The Al Jazeera conference was held in Doha in Qatar just this weekend, and Hamas's leader was given a platform to speak to the world. Since the ceasefire was announced in Gaza, they've released footage that shows a clear link to Hamas. They've got footage of Sinwar and others that nobody else has.
In terms of, you know, the allegation then, of course, that Israel has killed the highest number of journalists in a short period of time or whatever it would be, how much water then does that hold?
How much water does the
allegation
carry? Well, you know, Al Jazeera is set up a very clever network. So let's be really clear. It's state media for Qatar. So everything they do is Qatari-connected and Qatari-owned. Qatar has not been a fair or even actor in this. They are the central founders of the Muslim Brotherhood. They are providing huge amounts of money to Muslim Brotherhood action around the world. So there's clear links to Qatari money for Islamic State and other sort of fairly malign actors around the world, including funding extremist mosques in Europe. And so the idea that their state media should be a fair and impartial player is quite frankly ridiculous. And they have a very well-established pipeline where people start their careers at Al Jazeera and go on to elsewhere. So their tentacles kind of stretch well beyond the normal reach of Al Jazeera, and are pretty seriously infecting quite a large amount of news agencies that we would normally consider credible in the past.
Those actors that have been moved from Al Jazeera, let's say, to the BBC or wherever they land up, is that an intentional strategy, or are they just influenced by their time in at Al Jazeera to continue with this narrative?
Well, I think it's a strategy to build influence around the world. And that's really what Qatar has been doing in many, many ways with the huge amount of money that they are sat on as a state. If we look at how they buy up influence in universities, you know, look at the King's College London, one of the most prestigious universities in London, has the Qatar Business Centre. They had a KCL branch in Qatar training Qatari army officers. You know, the fact they bought huge amounts of real estate, they sponsor political campaigns, you know, so Qatar's effort is to extend their international influence by a huge number of means, and then Al Jazeera is one of those. And so when you have a journalist who's left there and gone onwards, they then clearly have links still to Qatar and can be relied upon to put a certain spin on things.
How long have we known this? Let me give a bit more background to my question. To some extent, the way in which I kind of view it, and I might be completely wrong, is since October 7th, we've seen almost an activation of these types of actors within media environments, within different environments, almost around the world. Before that, we hadn't really seen it to the extent that we had. Should we have seen it? Has this been going on for so long as a strategy that was visible, or was it so subversive that we we could be forgiven for not taking this more seriously earlier on?
Well, we've known about some of Qatar's more malign activities for a reasonably long time, particularly since the height of ISIS, when it became clear that money streams were going from Qatar into those areas of Syria and Iraq that ISIS held. We've certainly not had a war of this kind, I don't think, since ISIS finished. Since that was pretty much during the last Trump administration. But I think this is probably the most impressive information operation of all time that's been run by Hamas in terms of how they've played the entire world. And it's not just Al Jazeera. It's built on 60 years of very clever propaganda, effectively. But I think it's very clear from 7th of October onwards that the media strategy was absolutely as important to Hamas as the military strategy. You know, look at the way they live-streamed their behavior on 7th of October and pushed that out to the world. And ever since then, they've had a really clear and obvious narrative that they're trying to push, and it's been done very successfully. And Al Jazeera has been one of the key vectors for pushing that narrative that Israel's genocidal and committing war crimes, and the poor Palestinians have done nothing to deserve anything that's happened in Gaza. And that's been a very clear narrative that Al Jazeera have run with.
Are you seeing an acceptance of this view that you've just expressed? I mean, you've gone out on social media. You're speaking about it quite openly. A number of people are. The J Post has had an article which got very little traction about some of the documents found in Gaza, the connection between Hamas and Al Jazeera. But are you starting to see that this is being received, or are you still are we still shouting against the wind in this?
No, we are absolutely shouting into the wind, and it's very frustrating, but it just goes to show you the level of influence that Qatar has built. I mean, only recently we had visits from the Al Thanis, the ruling family of Qatar, and our king was quite happy to pose next to him. You know, Qatar have done a brilliant job of buying football teams and university places. And, you know, even the BBC use academics who I know have taken money from Qatar to go and work there for years. And those academics' analysis have been deeply skewed, biased, and frankly, an outrage in some of the stuff they've said. And it can't be a coincidence, but no, nobody seems to be listening at this point. I had a chance to speak in the House of Lords in a committee just a few months ago, and we had the head of Ofcom, who's Britain's media regulator, in there, And I mentioned the Al Jazeera issue, and he sort of nodded and agreed, and then kind of shrugged that there was little he could do. So, you know, there is a very, very powerful movement behind Qatar, and it's going to be incredibly difficult to dislodge it because they have invested so much cash in Western societies.
And it's on all different levels. In other words, it's not just
from politics to universities to you know, infrastructure to property. You know, it goes very deep, unfortunately.
Well, you're a military strategist. Are you a bit jealous of how brilliant this is?
Yeah, and it just shows you what you can achieve with money.
Right. There's that. You know, there's that. Yeah.
If you have unlimited sovereign wealth, there's an awful lot you can achieve. So yes, I would much prefer the UK to be richer and be able to do this stuff better. But also, I think it speaks to the lack of democracy in Qatar as well. Authoritarian states, dictatorships effectively, can get away with this stuff because they don't have an electorate to be accountable to. They don't have the mechanisms that we have in Western democratic states to hold people accountable when they quite blatantly act outside the rules. And these authoritarian states have that free pass because they don't have that accountability. And we see that with Russia and China, with certain Gulf states, and so on and so forth. And it's you know, it's a real flaw in democracy in some ways that we are accountable. Not that that's not a good thing. I'm firmly in favour of accountability,
of
but
course.
It does make life easy
if you're not. Actors. Yeah, exactly. The problem is, when it runs away with itself. It's 500 days since this war began, and we were asking listeners a little bit earlier some of the things that they've learned in 500 days. Can you just tell me about who you were 500 days ago? Were you aware, involved in monitoring these types of activities in Israel, Gaza, the Middle East, or have you taken an interest afterwards? And what is it that you've learned over this time?
So 500 days ago, I was a guy who had a deep interest in the Middle East academically. That's what I'd focused my master's study on. I had a deep interest in disinformation generally, because that's what I focused my psychology studies on. And then a war in the Middle East kicked off with loads of disinformation, so I had something to say. But 500 days ago, I was mainly appalled at what was coming over my Telegram channel. And even more appalled by what was happening on the UK streets with the celebrations that happened on that day.
Yeah.
You know, at that point, my main concern was my Jewish friends in England, who were clearly not only devastated by the events in Israel, but also devastated by the reaction of certain elements of British society. And so that's really been the start of a journey for me of standing next to and alongside and supporting the UK's Jewish community, who are under real pressure at the moment. You know, it's important to me that they know that the silent majority support Jewish people, and you know, I've been very vocal about that. So that's kind of been where I've been 500 days ago. But the main thing I've learned is the pain and the horror that was inflicted on Israel. I think unless you've been there, you can't quite understand how interconnected as a society Israel is. It's kind of, people are closer to each other in a way that I don't think they are in many other countries, frankly. And you can see the sort of societal injury that 7th of October caused. And of course, I've become friends with some of the hostage families as well. My friend Adam, his cousin, still in Gaza. And you know, seeing what those poor families have been through has been, you know, it's been terrible to watch. And you know, hopefully, a bit of public support has gone a very small way to helping them through this terrible time.
Well, you have been a tremendous supporter. That's I think very, very, very much appreciated. What has been, you know, you must have received a tremendous amount of negativity, pushback, and repercussions for your vocal support. How have you handled that?
It's been interesting. I've had to change my Twitter settings, my X settings, so that I don't see half of the notifications I get, because frankly, it just drags you down. You just don't need that nonsense in your life. What's been really interesting for me is the amount of anti-Semitic abuse I get.
Which obviously, I'm really sorry to hear that. Yeah.
Being Roman Catholic is not something you expect.
No, abuse. One wouldn't. Yeah.
But having a surname Fox, I think, misleads people sometimes.
Right.
Because I believe that's quite a common Jewish surname in some parts of the world.
Yeah.
But But yeah, I mean, every name you've ever called or been heard, I've been called as well. So I'm firmly in the scrap with you to a certain extent. But it's been interesting to see the depth of anti-Semitism. That's you know, it was something I was aware of. I knew it was a thing. I hadn't realised, frankly, the scope and the extent and the breadth of it. That's been a real eye-opener for me.
Well, I think if it's any consolation, it was to Jews as well. Not only Roman Catholics with Jewish-sounding surnames. It's one of the things that, you know, when I ask listeners what shocked you or what have you learned in the 500 days, almost across the board, it's the level of hatred, that it was this idea or perception that it was there just beneath the surface waiting to explode, and it did, because it even did so prior to Israel retaliating or moving into Gaza. We were seeing demonstrations against Israel well before it started, so there was little doubt as to what that was about, and it certainly wasn't even about the Palestinians.
And that kind of brings us full circle in this conversation, because Al Jazeera has had a huge role to play in that. You know, their mission for the last 500 days has been to demonize the world's only Jewish state. And that's obviously had a huge knock-on effect in terms of the way not only Israel, but also the diaspora has been treated.
Mm. In terms of the strategy moving forward, obviously the most important thing at this point is to secure the release of the hostages. But do you have thoughts in how you think Gaza should look after this is all done and dusted?
Yeah, it's such a tricky one. I mean, I'm not keen on Trump's plan. I don't think it's workable. And I think actually if you shift the population of Gaza elsewhere, that's just going to send those countries up in flames. We've got a very good historical set of examples as to what happens when you get large Palestinian diasporas. We've seen what happened in Jordan with Black September. We saw what happened in Lebanon. And I think it would take an enormous financial inducement to get countries to take them. So I kind of take the fact that Palestinians are still going to be in Gaza as my starting point for that analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's what happens when the hostages are released. I mean, does the war restart? How do you get rid of Hamas without military force? And if you do restart, does it mean the IDF has to fully occupy? Because, you know, if we look at Western counterinsurgency ratios, you need one soldier for every 40 to 50 civilians. That's 300,000 troops into Gaza. And I just don't see that the IDF's got that ability to operate at scale and mass for a long duration that a counterinsurgency campaign takes. I mean, Afghanistan took 20 years and we didn't get anywhere.
Absolutely.
So it's an incredibly tricky problem, both militarily and politically. And I may have more solutions for you in about a week's time, because I'm going to a conference where we're going to talk about this exact topic.
But for now, we'll definitely check in with you after that. But just a final question. A few people are asking, how much success can there be, given what we've discussed a little bit earlier, when a country like Qatar, who is very, very much a non-neutral actor, is part of the negotiations?
No, I agree completely, and I think it was actually a strategic mistake to allow Qatar to be involved to the extent that they have. I mean, look, this is a country that hosted the leadership of Hamas for a long time.
Absolutely.
It's a country that hosted the leadership of the Taliban for a long time, and, you know, and they've somehow managed to set themselves up as international negotiators, and I think that was a really bad decision to allow them to do that, and I think the duration of the war and the way it's gone is a reflection of that in part.
That is all we have time for. Unfortunately, fascinating conversation. Thank you for giving us the time and for all that you do. Also, apologies for all your suffering of anti-Semitism that you have to endure. That is Major Andrew Fox. He's a former British Army officer talking to us about Al Jazeera, about Qatar, and about the situation in general.